Hi, this is Jen Rubin, and this is Jen Rubin's Green Room. If you're like me, you've been rather down on the American people since the election. They don't pay attention to the news. They're uninformed. They voted to put into power an insurrectionist, a liar, a thief. Are they lost? Is there any kind of way we can restore an intelligent, democratic populace that is actually going to care about democracy, that's going to care about the truth? I mean, you're absolutely entitled to be despondent at some point. If people don't want to inform themselves, if they consciously choose to get their news from Elon Musk or from some weird podcast, what hope do we have as a democracy? Isn't part of a democracy, really all of a democracy, dependent upon an educated, conscientious citizenry? Well, if you're like me, you have probably thought, you know, these people need to go to citizenship school. You know what? There is a citizenship school. Our guest today, Eric Liu, had a brilliant idea, and that is to revive citizenship. He's created something called Citizens University, and he is spreading the gospel of citizenship throughout the country. And isn't that what we need? We need people to get out of their little cubbyholes, to get off the couch, to get into their communities, to start thinking of something bigger than their own self-interest. And I'm interested to see what success he has. I'm interested to find out what are the kind of people that are joining this movement and whether this is one way we come back from the disastrous election. So I'm thrilled to have Eric. Eric, welcome to the show.
Well, so great to be here, Jen.
You know, as I was telling the audience, many of us have kind of sort of given up on the American people. We're kind of disgusted with the election results. But you are the eternal optimist and have a plan to draw people out of their ideological tailspin and give them something that's bigger than themselves to be excited about and interested about. So tell us about Citizen University.
Well, sure, Jen. I think, first of all, I mean, I feel that pain too. I feel, you know.
Yes.
No one is immune to the pain of these times. And actually, though, to me, that is the way in or the way out as well. I believe that, well, for one thing, my theory of politics is that all politics is pain relief.
And, that's nice, yes.
You know, and it turns out a presidential election is a very blunt, literally binary instrument for pain relief, right? It is not satisfying, but it will give you a referendum one way or another. But what we should be paying attention to beyond the election results is the fact that for more than 40 years, this country has been saturated in so much pain and grief and loss that has gone unnamed, unrequited, unaddressed in different forms. And that can be the deindustrialization of our economy, that can be the kind of grinding inequality that's just made people feel in the marrow of their bones, this kind of zero sum, I got to look out for myself because someone's going to screw me over, kind of air that we're breathing. It's 20 plus years of war in Iraq and Afghanistan that we never as a people properly grieved. It is COVID, which we never properly grieved. You know,
yep.
So you have so much pain and I think that it's in a certain way not surprising that Donald Trump won. Donald Trump offered pain relief. Now, you know, I don't like it. I don't believe his remedies. But he offered pain relief. And he often offered it in the form of, I will inflict pain on someone else to make you forget yours, right? And so I think the way that we try to go through this is to not focus on Donald Trump or the Trump administration only, but to actually go to these underlying drivers of what hurts, what is broken in the body politic and in the heart of our democracy right now. And I know that sounds much more woo-woo. I'm in Seattle, you're in DC. I know it's not, you know, for a lot of Jen Rubin listeners, this is like, what is this kind of woo-woo stuff? It's not woo-woo. This is the stuff that Donald Trump has a savant-like ability to tap into and tune into. He's not even conscious of his ability, but you know, we who care about sustaining our democracy have to tune in this way.
And I think we underestimate what the MAGA movement gave people. It gave them a sense of belonging, a sense of purpose. You know, we have this epidemic of mental health, of loneliness, of alienation. So many people live alone. He gave them something that they were not otherwise getting. But you want to give them something better. If that's the toxic, you know, soup, you want to give them something more nourishing and sustaining. So tell us about what you do and what your group does.
Yeah, thank you for that. I just wanted to kind of give that preamble on pain because I felt like, you know, it's real. It's where we are.
Absolutely.
Citizen University, we're a nonprofit organization that works all around the United States. And our work is about trying to strengthen a culture of powerful citizenship. And that emphasis on culture is important. All of our programs are about equipping and empowering people in the places where they live to change the dynamic of if you were to ask, what's the culture of your town, of your neighborhood? What's the culture of Tulsa? What's the culture of not even Seattle, South Seattle? What's the culture? People would have a lot of answers there, but you would be able to ask, is it a place where people show up? Is it a place where people look out for each other? Is it a place where people know their neighbors? Is it a place where people feel like they're just isolated atoms bouncing off each other, getting in their cars, avoiding each other? Or are there kind of bonds of trust and affection that hold some people together, right? And these things are not rocket science. I think it is possible for any of us at any time to be a catalyst of a civic culture change where we live. Our programs at Citizen University, we operate from a notion that the simple equation that power plus character equals citizenship. To live like a citizen in the way that I mean, a contributing member of the body, requires both a literacy in power, understanding who decides things where I live. If you can't answer the question who decides where you live, then it really doesn't matter how much you paid attention to national politics, because you will have been part of a whole kind of ramifying series of people abdicating the responsibility for self-government, right? And who decides is not just like, who's my city council? Who decides is, who's the elder on my block? Who are the faith leaders that people turn to? Who is the small business person that people trust, you know, when times are tough? Who are the bridgers in my community who really are able to kind of talk to very different tribes or different groups of folks? And so a literacy in power is one thing that our programs teach. And our programs are cross-generational. We're teaching young people, we're teaching, you know, seniors how to read a map of power in your community, how to redraw that map, and how to understand yourself in it. But then the other half of that equation about civic character is about a set of norms of mutuality and reciprocity and service and a form of belonging, to your point about MAGA communities. A form of belonging that is defined not on putting down anybody or scapegoating anybody or blaming anybody, but is about inviting people in all of their brokenness, in all of their things that you might find objectionable, and asking, how can we see each other again? And how can we commit in our norms and our habits to living together? Like, that is the core American question. Can we live together, right? And other societies that are more homogenous, either ethnically or religiously or otherwise, you know, it's just a given they live together, right? It's the opposite of a given for us. And yet we don't have the habit. And so our programs, which I can tell you more about specifically, are about teaching power and cultivating character.
So someone signs up, they hear about this, and they show up. What do they do? What are the kinds of things that they have available to them?
Yeah, so one of our programs is called Civic Saturdays, and these are gatherings that are essentially a civic analog to a faith gathering. And so if you literally are feeling lost, alone, isolated, want to connect but don't know where and don't know how, Civic Saturdays are happening in hundreds of communities around the country. And we are just – and they are a – an analog to a faith gathering in the sense that you are invited in as a stranger. You are kind of invited to meet the people next to you. You're invited to talk about hard questions right away that go past small talk. We sing together. There are readings of texts that you can think of as civic scripture, texts from our history, texts from our current times that make us reflect on what are we doing here? And you know, someone gives a civic sermon, and then afterwards people kind of form up into circles to figure out, like, how can we build on this? How can we kind of convert this feeling of connection that I was hungry for into some sustained form of engagement in my neighborhood or in my community, right? So we train people all around the United States to lead these Civic Saturday gatherings. That's one program. Another program is called the Civic Collaboratory. And this is a program that teaches people how to practice the age-old forgotten habit that Ben Franklin knew well of mutual aid. When people ask, how do we save our democracy? Our democracy is on fire. My answer is always be like Ben. What Ben Franklin did, apart from sitting in the Constitutional Convention, all that, what he did was as an inveterate, habitual club maker and club joiner, right?
Right.
And the essence of every club he made, from a book club to a scientific club to the thing that would become the first fire department, was to embed practices of mutuality. And so the Civic Collaboratory brings people together who are different civic innovators or catalysts from different backgrounds. And what makes it more than just a networking group is that at every meeting, members take turns in rotation presenting to the full group some project or endeavor, something they're trying to move in the community. And then the rest of the group has to offer not critique or commentary, but hard commitments of help and investments of capital of every kind, relational, wow, intellectual, institutional, financial. And then what goes around comes around, right? And when you actually get into a habit of what goes around comes around in a good sense of taking turns helping each other, you build that muscle. You rebuild these habits of again, this is the precursor to self-government, right? Being able to deal with people unlike you, support each other in common endeavors, get over whatever initial notion you might have had that this person's different from me, and realize that by doing this over and over again in a repeated way, you're actually strengthening the ecosystem of the place where you live, right? That's the stuff that Tocqueville described when he came here 200 years ago, right?
Right.
He didn't go sit and watch the Senate debate. He didn't go and listen to what was happening in the House of Representatives. He went into the communities where practices like these were just matter of course. They've fallen away now. And so you now have to have a citizen university like my organization show up and start kind of contriving or recontriving invitations into this kind of practice. But that's another one of our programs, which we have one that's national, but now we're spreading them in a local place-based way, where the people in Atlanta have formed an Atlanta Civic Collaboratory. In Arizona, they've created one that is urban-rural, not just Phoenix, in other parts of the country that way. And I think that these are the kinds of things that, when I say culture, what I mean is these kinds of practices, the norms, the habits, the values, the stories we tell about ourselves, the ways in which we define and determine how to live together and what we think is okay. And we know in national politics that a president can poison civic culture, but only we at a human scale, place after place, can actually detoxify and repair civic culture. And that's what these programs are about.
What I love about this is that the content is driven by the participants. If you want to affect, you know, clean up in your park, that's a choice that you make. In other words, you are empowering people to make decisions about what's important to them. I think people too often sit around and saying, I have all these problems. What's your answer?
Yes.
And you kind of reverse that formula and say, what do you want to do? What do you care about? And what can you do to help? That sounds like it could be very empowering for people who have kind of become passive. You know, they sit, they scroll on the internet, they watch TV, but now you're making them active.
Well, I think what we're doing is we're inviting them to be active. And it turns out that people, if you extend the invitation and make it real and make it relational, people realize pretty quickly they were kind of hungry for this. You know?
I mean,
and that sense of passivity you're describing, by the way, cuts across every demographic, right? I mean, all your readers of the Washington Post, people who, look, I cut my teeth in politics working in D.C., in the Senate, in the White House. Like, I know that world. I know what it's like to be absorbed in the goings on and the concerns within the Beltway. And it's precisely that community of folks who often are the most kind of who have fallen into the deepest pit of learned helplessness and passivity, you know, doom scrolling, thinking that it's all or none, thinking that either, you know, either you have this president or democracy is doomed. No, no. Go show up in Tacoma Park. Go show up in Southeast DC. Go show up where you live. And certainly if you are living outside of the Beltway, you know, engage in these ways. And, you know, the other thing that Ben Franklin knew that was kind of his genius was, you know, the best way to, quote, make somebody do something or teach something is to ask them to teach it to you. That kind of like, hey, I would like to get involved. Could you help me do this? Like that invitation
is a thing that
also is missing in American life, right? We're all in our private bubbles.
And it also bestows respect on the other people. They're worth being asked to do something, which is a way of kind of equalizing kind of disparities. So I'm interested in two things. One is, who are the kinds of people that you have attracted? Mm-hmm. And secondly, how does this relate to your own past, your own immigrant story? When I must say, every time I see one of these naturalization ceremonies, or I have a friend who becomes a naturalized citizen, it just emotionally grabs me. And because people who have come to this country appreciate it much more because we've taken it for granted.
Yeah.
So talk to us a little bit about those two things. First of all, what the kind of makeup of the people are that attend, and then how this kind of relates back to the immigrant story. Yeah,
for sure. You know, the makeup, you know, we have people trained in 40 some states of the country and in small towns of 500 and, you know, in big cities. And so the people who come are a pretty good cross section of what, our friends at the public opinion research organization called More in Common describe as the exhausted majority, right?
Yeah.
So we don't get kind of hardcore ideologues of MAGAland or of the far left, generally right. speaking. But you get a pretty wide swath of the exhausted majority, right?
Yeah.
You know, people who are coming because they feel like something's broken. They want to be part of the solution. They don't quite know how, and they don't want to be alone and trying to figure out how, right? Now, right. that describes lots of people, some of whom are Republican, some of whom are independent and Democrat, some of whom have voted for Donald Trump. Most have not, in all likelihood, but some have. And I think the breadth of people, age, demographics, race, faith, is a real wide kind of a snapshot of the diversity of our country. What it is, and I will say this, it is like your listeners, the self-selected group of people who've decided
right.
not to give up on things, right?
Right.
And I know that we are the minority. You know, we are the minority within the exhausted majority, people who have decided not to give up and decide that we want to try to do something, right?
Right.
But that's okay. I think part of our worldview at Citizen University is that, you know, I mean, democracy works on majority rule, but majority rule depends on minority will. It's always an activated minority that chooses to keep on showing up to make culture change. And that's in every direction. That's in progressive directions like the civil rights movement. That's in, you know, retrograde directions like MAGA, right? But the in both cases, and by the way, I mean, organizations on the right, like I don't like any of the policy agenda of Moms for Liberty. But
they figured it out.
You know,
yes.
You don't like what's going on in your school district? Run for school board. That option is available to all, right? And I think that's how this relates to my family journey. And, you know, I am the child of immigrants. My parents were born in mainland China during that time of war and revolution and civil war, and went to Taiwan and then to the United States. And I was born in outside of Poughkeepsie, New York. Right. And, you know, IBM town, the peak of IBM's power at nearly the peak of American power and prosperity and kind of global power and so forth. And I just grew up with this sense all the time. It was very rarely vocalized, but always felt that all I did was have the dumb luck to be born here. Right.
Yeah.
My parents did the heavy lifting. Others have others have made it possible for me to get to explore and do the things that I get to do. And so therefore, every opportunity it's not even that it comes with an obligation. Every opportunity is an obligation, right? It's sort of what Gary Wills, in his wonderful book about the founding generation, Inventing America, he wrote about the ways that thinkers of the Scottish Enlightenment shaped Jefferson into thinking that rights didn't come with duties, but that rights properly understood were duties, right? Yeah. That's a very American idea. It's also a very second generation son of immigrants idea, right? Every right is a duty, right? And so I think that's my worldview in general. When you were talking, Jen, about how moving it is to go to a naturalization ceremony, we actually at Citizen University, the co-founder of Citizen University, I want to name my late wife, Janae Kane. She was a theater artist and a real civically oriented, community-centered theater artist. And I had spoken at one or two of these naturalization ceremonies. And by the way, for your listeners, if you've never been to one, go find one. Like, they're happening all the time in your town, sometimes in a courthouse, sometimes in a library, whatever. Go find one. We'd been to enough where we came back from one, and Janae said, man, that was amazing how moving it is and how kind of, you know, even though it's got, you know, bureaucratic language and Department of Homeland Security, you know, stuff, but it is so fundamentally moving when people are asked to rise during the roll call of countries where they're from and then told the next time you sit down, you will be Americans, right?
Yeah. Isn't that amazing?
And Janae said, what if we had something like that for all of us? Why is it only immigrants and those who are close to them who get to see and experience this? And then she's from South Louisiana. So then she started riffing on the whiteboard. She started drawing this, like, it could be like a revival spirit, like a revival tent. But she said, instead of being born again, you'd be sworn again, you know, with a new oath. And out of that little brainstorm came a project that we created at Citizen University called Sworn Again America. And we created a very simple nonpartisan oath that is very oriented around service and being useful to community and country. It's agnostic as to documentation status. It's, you know, it ends wherever my ancestors and I were born, I claim America and I pledge to live like a citizen. And we created this oath. We created a simple template of a ceremony for it. We seeded it at a few places around the country, the White House during the Obama years, conferences, military bases, college campuses. But then we let people run with it. And this has been happening all over the country in ways that, again, it goes to the thing that you named and felt, Jen, but the thing that we added, which I want to say is really important, we added a dose of ritual. Like, it's not enough to feel. A lot of people feel a yearning. They feel it. But Civic Saturdays are a ritual. They're inviting you into a space that takes you out of the normal flow of time, just like a religious service would, to make you reflect on what we owe each other and what we owe this country, right? The Sworn Again America ceremony can last 10 minutes, but it takes you, people leave in tears. Like, people get choked up giving this oath because it takes you out of taking things for granted. And ritual is important for that.
I got to say, ritual, I can't emphasize this enough. Every religion, every sport, every kind of activity has these things. And it's what's kind of passed down, what takes you out of yourself, because you're then in a different realm. You're in the realm where everyone stands up at the seventh inning stretch. You're in the realm where everyone is, you know, taking an oath. It kind of gets you out of yourself a little bit and puts you in a different kind of emotional setting, a different social setting. So I can't stress enough to people, and that's why I think people who live alone, people who are lonely, are such a problem in our society, because they miss that. They miss that connection. They become isolate. And we really have to work on that. So, as you say, you have a group of self-selecting, exhausted majority kind of folks. Are they then able to go back into the community and pull more folks? In other words, is this kind of a self-perpetuating process, so that you may start with 20 people, but maybe you're then really digging into the part of the population that wouldn't necessarily come willingly, but because George down the hall says, you got to come to this thing, they'll come.
Absolutely. That is literally our theory of action, you know, and the people we train, we call them civic catalysts. They may not be leaders with a capital L. They may not have titles, but they are all people who can spark change or an awakening or a shift. And when they go back to their communities, whether they're leading a Civic Saturday or building a local civic collaboratory or holding a Sworn Again America ceremony, they invite others, more people who are bystanders, people in their community who haven't been in a long time invited to join or show up or be part of something. And yeah, that is, you know, so, and to be very specific, like I think about people and places. We work with an organization based in Omaha and Lincoln, Nebraska, called Civic Nebraska. And they've been holding Civic Saturdays for years, and they're bringing people together every couple of months in ways that are not just the usual suspects. People who have been on the sidelines, people who might have voted for Donald Trump, but still want to be part of an ideologically mixed community of people who just want to make their town better, right? People who are part of the growing Hispanic immigrant communities in both those places. Next door in Kansas Leadership Center is an organization that we work with where we've trained people to go back to Kansas, to every one of the 106 counties of Kansas, you know, to invite people in both urban and rural settings to get involved. In Shreveport, Louisiana, we work with an organization called Community Renewal, where elders and educators in this largely Black community are working to kind of find new ways to reach young people and to be part of the civic and ethical formation of young people, right? And so that generational dynamic is important too, because when we think about people who are not the self-selected, who are not yet opting into civic life, there's a huge generational kind of map to that. Like the younger you are, the more likely you are to be checking out, not thinking about, and not joining and participating civic activity, at least in the traditional ways that it's been done. And so to get an invitation from someone you know or trust or have one, maybe 2 degrees of separation from in the place where you live, to join something that isn't just, you know, the old school kind of stuff, but what is this? This is kind of interesting, right? Is, I think, a way to widen this this field of people who take ownership and take responsibility for the health of the country.
Now, next year, I have this fantasy, can be a great learning opportunity because it is, of course, the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of the founding of the country. What kinds of things do you think can spring from that? What are the sorts of ideas, the sorts of programs that you could perhaps build around that? Because it, I remember, you know, the bicentennial minutes, it was a great learning opportunity. What are the kinds of things that might spring up next year or might take advantage of because of the 250th anniversary?
Oh my goodness. Well, first of all, I should say, I mean, there are so many wonderful overlapping networks of organizations planning and preparing all kinds of events, projects, celebrations, opportunities for engagement during 2026 for the 250th. And some of them are nationwide. Some of are at national institutions like the National Constitution Center. But many of them are state-based and in turn states kind of seeding local activity. State humanities councils or kind of history institutions. There's a network of museums and history institutions called Made by Us, which the Smithsonian is a big anchor part of, but there are organizations like the Atlanta History Center and, you know, the Wing Luke Museum in Seattle, all these different places around the country that are networked, and all of their, they are working like this great flotilla, inviting people in the communities and that these institutions serve to generate ideas for ways to mark the 250th. And it goes back to what we were talking about at the start of this conversation, invitation to participation, right? Rather than, hello, would you like to be a passive audience to a show, right?
Right.
National politics is a show. We watch this show. We yell at the show. We hate watch. We, you know, whatever, right? But local civic life is not a show. It is a thing we are co-authors of. We are co-producers and co-creators of. And the 250th is going to be a great opportunity for people to be reminded of that in a way that's not, eat your vegetables. You should be doing more civically, right. You know, but rather like, right. This is joy. This is a joy. Yeah. Well, it's joyful opportunity to kind of remember what we can be. But it's also a good opportunity. I don't mean to be Pollyanna. It's a good opportunity for us to face ourselves, face history and ourselves and say, okay, like the 250th of this country is a good time for people in Tulsa. You know, 2026 will be 3 years after the 100th anniversary of the Tulsa massacres and the Tulsa race massacre, yeah. right? And the yeah. destruction of Black Wall Street in the Greenwood neighborhood. And big round numbers like 100 or 250 are good.
Yeah.
But actually, 2026 will be a good time for folks in Tulsa to ask, how are we doing at 103? Is Tulsa yeah. better at right. 103 than it was at 102? Right. You know, 100 years
after. That's a great point.
Right?
It's a great point.
That mindfulness that it's not just about the big round number years, that mindfulness that it's not just about, yay, America, America's awesome, but rather let 250 is a pretty, you know, is not a young country anymore.
Right.
We are growing up, and grown-ups should be able to walk and chew gum. Grown-ups should be able to celebrate what is worth celebrating and face what is worth reckoning with, right?
Right.
And I think this is, too, where the exhausted majority is, right? Even though the history wars and the wars about patriotism in our political culture and national politics seem so polarizing, again, I'm going to quote our friends at More in Common. They did a report on the history wars, and they found that most Americans, what they want to be taught and talked about is our history, warts and all, but not all warts.
Like, exactly. Exactly. It's a great message.
The 250th is a great time for us to ask, what does warts and all, but not all warts, look like in Tallahassee? What does that look like, you know, in Brownsville, Minnesota? What does that feel like in Colorado Springs, right? Let's face ourselves and celebrate ourselves and be a little more grown up than we were, say, for the bicentennial.
Well, that is a phenomenal aspiration and sentiment. I hope it sticks. So tell the audience one more time, if they want to get involved in your organization, or specifically if they want to do something for the 250th anniversary, where did they go? How do they connect?
You bet. So Citizen University, we're very findable online. The URL is just one word, Citizen University, no S, citizenuniversity.us. That's our website. You know, a couple places I would send people to for engaging on the 250th. One is called Made by Us, that network of history institutions and museums. The other is the National Constitution Center. But the third thing I would mention, I've had the chance over the last few years to co-chair a project at the American Academy of Arts and Sciences called Our Common Purpose. My co-chairs are, maybe have been your guests, Daniel Allen at Harvard, and who's written for the Post in the past, and Stephen Heinz, who is the head of the Rockefeller Brothers Fund. And the three of us have co-chaired this national bipartisan cross-ideological group of folks working on projects and ideas to revitalize our democracy. And so that network, and we have a whole body of work that's taking us to 2026, tons of opportunities for people to plug in. So if you just Google Our Common Purpose, you'll find an organization, a set of reports, a set of kind of white papers about projects, and then lots of opportunities to learn about. If what you care about is the voting system and you want to do ranked choice voting, join this organization. If what you care about is you know, getting veterans more engaged in civic life upon their return, join this campaign and organization. There's kind of a one-stop shop for these kinds of projects.
That is phenomenal. Well, I think we had you on this program at exactly the right time, because I think as people end the year, we want to have them say, this is not the end of something. This is not the beginning of your retreat from public life,
yes.
but this is the opportunity. If you're tired of the show, turn off the show and get involved in your own community, in your own citizenship. And I love that idea. I think it gives people hope and purpose. And I am thrilled to see that you're making as much headway as you are. And I can't wait for 2026. And you know, what's going to roll out. I'm really looking forward to it.
But Jen, I got to say one thing for your listeners too, because
sure.
you know, you are leading by example. You have a national platform in a national publication talking national politics much of the time. And to carve out space on that platform to remind people that, you know, the same way that all politics is local, all citizenship is local, right? And that what we've got to do, that bottom up, inside out, middle out renewal is the only path forward. And I think that, you know, I can say that doing the work that I do in communities, but when you say that, Jen, from the position you're sitting in, it carries that much more weight. So thank you for really giving space to this message.
Oh, it's absolutely my pleasure. And we'll have you back before 2026 to see how you're doing on the project. So thank you so much for joining us and good luck in everything you're doing.
Thanks, Jen.
And that was Eric. Really interesting stuff. And it did give me some hope. I think there are lots of ways. There's no one solution. There's no one program. There's no one media option. There's no one democratic reform. We really need to try a lot of things. And this is one thing that can help. I still maintain that the problem is when people are isolated online, listening to podcasts by themselves, they get into this crazy loop. Frankly, it's caused by the algorithms on social media. And so they become more isolated, more crazy, more convinced that the other side is out to destroy Western civilization. But if you can actually get people out to communicate in person, to actually see other people, to do things in the community, and to look at the example of immigrants who come to this country with nothing, who make lives for themselves, who study about the Constitution, who work hard, who find the American dream in America. If we can get more people to do that, I think we'll be okay. We don't need to get 350 million people to do it. We need maybe a few million more to get engaged. After all, we didn't lose this election by millions and millions and millions of votes. We lost by about 130,000 or so who, had they switched sides in the key states, would have put Kamala Harris in office. It doesn't take that much to move the needle. And I firmly believe that giving people an option to reconnect with neighbors, to reconnect with Americans, to feel better about themselves and joining something positive will help wean them away from the MAGA movement. I think liberals made a mistake in thinking that the MAGA movement didn't offer something to a lot of people. It did. It gave them a sense of belonging. It may be crazy. It may be a cult. But that's why people join these kinds of movements, to feel connected, to feel important. What if we gave them something else, something more positive, something more uplifting? Well, you might make some progress. So I think we're going to need a lot of these efforts, and I'm thrilled that Eric has come up with a really smart, inventive method of kind of getting people out of their homes, out of their ideological niches. So maybe we're not completely done for, but I would leave you with this thought. Scroll less, read and meet people more. And I think that's a good formula for everyone. So if you like the show, if you like our other shows, please tell your friends. They can listen, follow us, subscribe, wherever they get their podcasts. Bye-bye.